Hello, this is Lex, and welcome to the Next Step Remote podcast, where I have the pleasure to interview some of the best remote work experts from all over the world. In each episode, we cover a topic, success story, or challenge to help you make remote work work. Enjoy. Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, boys and girls. A few weeks ago, I interviewed Matteo Grassi, one of the founders of the Next Step Group, about the dark side of remote working. And his passionate rant on mental health inspired me to explore the area a bit further. I want to do this for two reasons. One, despite getting better in recent years, mental health is still a taboo topic. And secondly, we underestimate or are simply unaware of just how big of an impact it has on our lives. And with the sudden shift to remote working, I feel it's even more important to talk about it. The scope of this next mini-series will be quite broad, so we'll cover not just mental health, but also inclusion and diversity. I'm not exactly sure where going down this rabbit hole will lead, but I'm excited and somewhat anxious to find out. And to start us off, I'm joined today by Lorraine McKinnon. Lorraine has spent her career working on hard-to-solve problems, from helping millions of Americans save for retirement to helping companies prevent sexual harassment. She blends behavioral science, big data, and practical implementation. Lorraine is a talent and culture strategist, the president of a women's leadership nonprofit, founder of a talent incubator, and to top it all off, in 2018, she was named a woman of influence in Silicon Valley. Lorraine, it's fantastic to have you. That's a very impressive intro. My first question for you is, whereabouts in the world are you?
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I'm glad to be here today, especially around such an important topic of mental health and the workplace. I am based in Silicon Valley. So I'm in a town called Redwood City, right in between San Francisco and San Jose. It's a great place to be doing workplace culture work. I'm about 15 minutes away from Facebook, a good portion of the Google campus. And there are lots and lots of startups that are redefining technology for financial services, for HR, for social media, et cetera, right outside my door.
Wow. So you could not be better placed to be basically in the center of influence on the tech sector.
Yeah, it's certainly a good place to be. And, you know, thinking now with the times of COVID and folks working from home, you know, I'm not very far from a lot of the biotech that's working on cure as well. So there are a lot of very smart people here in the Bay Area. A lot of people are attracted to this area because of the companies that are here. So it's particularly diverse, but it's also particularly difficult for companies to have, you know, five different generations in the workplace, people from all different backgrounds, all different cultures. And I know that's part of what we want to talk about today.
Absolutely. Absolutely. As I said, I'm very excited about the topic, but at the same, a tiny bit anxious because not only is it a taboo topic, it's also a bit of a politically correct minefield. And I'm never too sure what I can say, what I cannot say. I always trust my guts that I don't have the intention of offending or hurting anyone, but you can never be too sure. And obviously you have to take things like that into consideration. I've been thinking a lot about what we've gone through in the last few months, and yeah, it's been a strange time to say the least. I guess from your point of view, what are some of the impacts that you've seen the sudden move to remote working has had on people, especially when it comes to kind of inclusion and mental health point of view?
Yeah, I mean, it's such a broad question, and it's such a different situation for each individual. On the one hand, you know, working from home means that people are sitting with their family or they're by themselves. So it's either potentially very crowded with multiple generations in your house and not a whole lot of space, or you could be entirely by yourself and isolated and be a relatively social person who's really unused to not ever sort of having a human touch. So you may be looking for other ways to have interactions. I think it also really exacerbates or enhances the relationships that you had in the workplace. So you're no longer getting that mix of people that you're talking to every day simply by being at work and bumping into somebody in the elevator or walking down the hall. So you're going to gravitate towards the relationships that you had before. And because you're not getting those casual interactions, you're going to rely more heavily on those assumptions or perceptions that you have about other people, which mean the people that you think are difficult to work with are probably becoming more difficult, or at least your perception. And the people that you tend to interact with and really enjoy chit-chatting with are probably the people you've got a side chat with. So that's all being a bit exacerbated. And then, you know, clearly you're managing in this really unique time, pandemic, a racial justice movement around Black Lives Matter, and your point of view on both of those things is going to depend on your community and how much you're affected and impacted. On the COVID side, clearly, if you know somebody who has it, if you know people who have passed away from it or who are really struggling in ICU, your whole perspective and emotional state is very different from somebody else who maybe doesn't know anybody in their immediate circle or even beyond that who has the disease. So there's just so much going on right now. It's this extreme period and point of time where you've got to be sort of cautious of everything that you do. And maybe, as you point out, sort of cautious of the things that you say. So a really challenging time for folks.
No, absolutely. You know what? When I started thinking about this next miniseries that I'm embarking upon now, I wasn't sure where to start. I genuinely struggled because, as you said, it's such a broad topic. It's a question of what we class as mental health, which aspects do we need to talk about. Obviously, inclusion, diversity is a big part of it. And you mentioned people who have families, how do they cope? People who are single, how do they cope? And the topics I definitely would like to explore is the impact that COVID had on people, on parents, for example, how they manage. But also on introverts, because a phrase that I heard that remote working is an introvert's dream, an extrovert's nightmare. And I've got a good friend of mine who's an extrovert, and after a few days, he said, "I can't stare at the same four walls anymore. I just can't do it." And then I've got an introverted friend who said, "You know what? I'm in a way I'm loving it because I don't have the fear of missing out. I'm just kind of, I don't have that." So it is a blessing in disguise. I guess digging a little bit deeper on the inclusivity aspect that you mentioned, that people form their bubbles, that the people you liked, you will hang out virtually a bit more with. People that you maybe didn't find a common ground as much, you will have a negative perception that will just kind of be exacerbated. What are the repercussions from a mental point of view, do you think, on people? How does that impact the day-to-day and people's health?
Yeah, so I'm not a mental health expert, but I sort of look at each individual and try to understand where each individual might be coming from. And so there are a bunch of different things that could be happening, whether you're working on a project and you feel like somebody's being really aggressive or taking too much of your time. You know, maybe it's that person that you never got along really well with, but you managed to say hi in the office every once in a while. And so that sort of kept your tensions or your hackles down, right? When you sort of start working with somebody and you start to get frustrated and you feel that adrenaline starts to go, you found maybe other ways to manage it when you were in contact with that person, when you were there with them physically. You know, Zoom or any of these video conferencing, WebEx, are really helpful because you can see people, you can see reactions, but it's still not the same as being there in person. And some of the hormones and the sort of interactions that you get between human to human really do give you a lot more cues and information that help you to manage how you respond. And you're still missing that. You know, there's a wall here between us. The beauty of it is you can work more equally with anyone around the world because you're all in the little box on the screen. But the challenge is that you don't always get all the cues that you might otherwise. And so it really depends on how you as a person take in information, how much you listen, how open you are to new information versus how closed you are. It's kind of like the open mindset or growth mindset versus the fixed mindset. So if you assume that somebody is a certain way, everything that you hear will often reinforce that. It's the confirmation bias of having an expectation and then listening for things that confirm that expectation. If you're a little bit more adaptable, if you're a little bit more open, if you question your own self and your own assumptions, then you often find that people aren't the way you thought they were, or that you have been putting them into too narrow of a box. And I think for mental health, sort of in a more general, not in a practitioner or a clinical sense, but in a sort of common everyday framework, just taking a step back, listening a little bit more, asking yourself if you could be wrong, if you could have heard that wrong, if you made an assumption. You know, I was on a call the other day and I said something and I was like, ooh, I wonder if I should have said that. I hope I didn't offend anybody. And later at the end of the call, I got this little note from someone that said, so inappropriate. And I was like, oh my gosh, she's calling me out on it. I shouldn't have said that. I thought that, you know, I tried to sort of recover and say it the right way, but I didn't do it quite right. And I wrote back to her and I was going to address my point very specifically. And I said, you know what? I'm just going to say, I'm so sorry if it's something that I said. And she wrote back and it was about something entirely different. And I thought, oh, I'm so glad that I didn't double down on what I might have said that I thought could have, you know, just like rankled her a little bit, because it was something entirely different that she was reacting to. So sometimes it's just apologizing first and letting the person then come tell you what was bothering them, or it's, you know, just being really thoughtful and open. And I think if you can get yourself into that place, it takes a lot of the anxiety out of interactions. It takes a lot of the pretending or the role playing that you feel like you have to do, which takes a lot of mental energy away from the core conversation that you're trying to have. So I think, you know, being a little bit more open, trying to listen, asking more questions, asking open-ended questions can really help you hear from the other person as opposed to assuming what the other person thinks or does.
You know, I always wonder, because what made it worse? Is being remote making it more difficult for us, or is actually being in the office that this is more prevalent? Because in the office, I guess it's easier to go and vent to somebody else around the corner about somebody else, that about just what happened in the meeting. Whereas at home, you're basically on your own. So if you're single, you're stewing with yourself, or if you've got a family, you're floating on your partner. So is it like for like in a way, or is it one better than the other? What do you think?
Oh, it totally depends on the individual. Some people aren't safe at home, right? We know that there are incidences of domestic violence. We know that for many people, you know, and those incidents are increasing because there's more stress, there's more pressure. You know, things are very challenging. People don't have their outlets. People can't go to work where they might feel safer. On the flip side, I know a fair number of people who don't feel like psychologically safe at work, for whom they go to work and they dress a certain way and they act a certain way, and they're sort of, whether it's the way that they talk or the way that they have to kind of show up, it takes a huge amount of mental energy to play this role that they feel like they need to play at work. And so being home is a huge relief for them. It takes off this whole sort of amount of work that they need to do to show up at work. So it totally depends on the individual, and it depends on their adaptability. It depends a bit on their mindset and their situation at home and at work. Yeah, there's not one answer.
This brings me on actually to another question, because I often get asked when I work with organizations where we tackle not just remote working, but company culture, workplace culture, and how to kind of build the trust and relationships with people to get the best out of them. And with the sudden move to remote, a lot of organizations ask me, so how do we maintain our culture? What do we do? And my answer is, you know, it's very individual to your organization. It depends, you know, if you've got a strong culture, it's a question of just maintaining it in a slightly different way. But they ask the questions of how do we actually do it? Is it possible to recreate what they've had with slightly different rituals to maintain that? And I'm always a bit stumped by that question, although I've been asked that numerous times. But the nuance of the question is, where is the kind of responsibility? Is it just the leadership team that sets the tone of that? Or do the individuals within the ranks kind of have that responsibility as well? Because you did mention that everybody's different. It's all down to the individuals as well. So where's kind of that boundary, do you think, in this situation?
Yeah, I think the boundary is almost seamless. I do a ton of work on workplace culture. What happens at the top and the tone that's set and the vision and the way that that's communicated is extremely important. It's also really important that that's consistent. When something happens that's against the culture or the values of the organization, that that is handled pretty promptly and transparently. But it's absolutely true that every individual contributes to the culture and makes up the culture. So in the work that I do with M-Train, which is a culture tech firm based here in California, we have looked at over 2.5 million data points of employee sentiment on their workplace and their workplace culture through online training that we do. And it's quite clear that there are a few indicators. We have named six that sort of tell you about the health of a workplace culture. And there's these organizational norms, or like the way things really work around here, which ideally are very much aligned with the company's mission and values, but often can be misaligned. And it's both the responsibility of the senior leadership to take care of things when they are out of alignment, because they have the power and the oversight to do so, but also very much to individuals. So let's, for example, say, you know, there's some incident that happens. Someone has had bad behavior. First of all, they're much less likely to even try to sort of get away with the bad behavior if that's not the way things are done around here. If that's going to stand out as a really big offense, then they're not even going to try to get away with it. On the second hand, if they get away with the bad behavior and it's sort of like, oh, okay, that person has enough power to get away with that behavior. And so their peers and maybe their sort of direct manager don't go and give them feedback or remediate it, then you're looking for the top down. And the top down, the leaders are going to need to make a decision, right? Maybe this person has had an extreme act of bad behavior, but it happens to be your top salesperson. So what do you do? Right. And time and time again, and particularly, I think, in certain industries, you see that person getting away with that bad behavior, and leadership, you know, some person or people in leadership know about it and they have excused it because they think this person is, you know, such an amazing innovator or such an amazing salesperson, or we can't run the tech side of the business without this particular engineer. And so they give kind of more weight to the capabilities of that person and discount their impact on others through bad behavior. And then that bad behavior becomes the norm, or a certain group of people are allowed to have bad behavior. And then that becomes the norm, and nobody's going to remediate or give them any feedback because that's just the way things work around here. And so you can really see how that gets embedded in cultures, and cultures are built sort of every hour, every day, over years. There's an ebb and flow of people in and out of the company as new people come on board and sort of learn how things work or what you can and can't do, or if you need to say thank you every time you get something from someone, or if you can be more demanding about getting something from someone with a higher expectation that they turn it around in a certain amount of time, or if you ask for something from someone and they're kind of lax about getting it to you and you can't go and say, hey, where is that thing? Right? Like, it's just, it's all these interactions between all these people. And so I think the bigger question is less how does it happen or how does it work or where are the boundaries, or how do you make change when you've got to influence and impact everyone in the organization consistently every time something happens?
I've got a feeling that the answer to the question I'm going to ask now is at least 10 episodes on their own. But how do you tackle that? Just the thing that you just mentioned, that we have these basically varied standards for different people depending on their contributions. So I have not worked in it or worked for or with an organization that didn't have that. I think that's just part of a human nature or organizational nature. It's a form of bias for sure. Where do we even start with it? What do you think?
Yeah, well, I'm a big fan of data. I work in very, very large data sets. I have throughout most of my career. I'm very interested to know what individuals think, and I'm very interested to track some of the behaviors. Here in the U.S. in particular, we're very litigious, which means a lot of things will go to lawsuit. And the CEO of M-Train has founded the business because she saw things really getting wrapped in this sort of risk management and litigation protection framework. And she and I are so very aligned on, you know, people need to talk to each other. We need a bit more transparency. Organizations need to have a much better understanding of what's actually happening. And some organizations are concerned about transparency. They're concerned about, so something will happen and they won't address it. And you know, in a couple of months, this person's just gone and they never actually announce that the person has left the organization, for example. And they never really talk about bad behavior. But in fact, with social media, like employees basically know because they're on chats and they're having all these side conversations. They know what's happening more or less. And if the company is not handling it right, then they're going to go and they're going to put it out on a Medium post, which is what you've seen, you know, at Uber, at Google, Pinterest, or engineer at Pinterest who basically shamed Silicon Valley into starting to report their diversity and inclusion numbers by posting an article that said, "Hey, I know something's not right here. Show me the data." So I always go back to the data. I always go back to understanding employee sentiment. And I also go back to understanding the data about individual impact. So sure, you think this is your top salesperson and you've been forgiving of bad behavior, but what is the follow-on impact to how many people and how they've had to change the way that they do their job? Have they had fewer opportunities? Do they not highlight other potential issues within a client relationship because they just don't have the ability, the dynamics to raise it because this person's always going to be forgiven? And so what are the follow-on effects? And can you understand that from a revenue perspective or a productivity perspective or a lack of innovation perspective? Can you put numbers behind the broader impact that someone with bad behavior is having? And so that's where I spend some of my time. So I also run my own consulting firm and spend some of my time really looking at you know, the dollars behind the impact that you have when you've got some people who are really working outside of the stated culture, and you know how that top salesperson who has a good revenue number next to their name might actually have a negative number over here when it comes to teamwork and collaboration and embedded risks that the company just hasn't discovered yet.
The impact of that on everything that we've been talking about is just absolutely immense. And I wonder how much of it is that organizations don't know about it or are unaware, and how much of it is that they simply don't want to know. That's kind of always on my mind. You mentioned the Medium article. Is there any chance you've got a link to it anyway? Because I'd love to share it with
the listeners.
Yeah. That. I should be able to dig up a few of them, right? Where people have
fantastic
have basically said there's something going on here. Maybe they've tried to raise it through the formal channels to make sure the right people in the organization know about it, and you know, those people either haven't understood or haven't listened, or have, you know, tried to wrap it in a box so that the company protects itself. People just pop out to Medium and write, you know, an article with a lot of details, and there it is. So there's it's become a channel for people who feel like these things need to be made public and want to try them in the court of public opinion.
If you could share that with us, that would be fantastic. I'd love to include in the show notes, for people to have a read. The workplace culture, as we're talking about it, is such an intricate balance of people and personalities. And obviously, this podcast is as much about remote as possible, but it is ultimately problems that normal organizations face as well. If you were, I know, again, it's going to be a loaded and most of a very broad question, but if you were to give some advice to organizations of where they should look first, and potentially how should they approach it. You mentioned that you're very big on data. Maybe let's pick up that stream a little bit. What can organizations, apart from basically emailing you and saying, "Lorraine, can you please help us?" What can they do for themselves?
Yeah, I think it's a great time to be listening. I think it's a great time to be checking in with people. I have heard that that can be done too much, right? So managers are in a really awkward position. How do I make sure that the work is getting done, that it's getting done in the time frame that we need it, and I'm not going to have a surprise? So they tend to check in more, which can be really frustrating for the person who's like, stop checking in with me. I'm trying to get my work done. I think in HR roles, in diversity roles, in HR business partner roles, it's reaching out to people that you might not otherwise talk to, that might not be in your meetings day to day, just to get a sense of how that person is doing and what they're seeing and what they're experiencing. So, you know, just trying to have those hallway conversations in a virtual hallway, I think is really, really important. I mentioned that M-Train does online training, and we've basically embedded a culture survey in required training. So here in California, in New York, in other states, employees must have sexual harassment prevention training. So in Preventing Workplace Harassment course, we'll embed a whole series of culture survey type questions. And that's a form of listening. Whether people are doing pulse surveys or sending out other culture surveys, that's a form of listening. You may have had a lot of events in your organization in the past, you know, in-person events where you had speakers or panelists, or maybe you showed a movie. I love working with the team over at Storybolt. They have a number of short documentaries, and they'll show the movie and then often have a conversation with the filmmaker. And, you know, the group that saw the movie together can have a conversation about what they just saw. And that's something that ports beautifully over to online, where you can still get this community of people. I see a lot more use of chat and a lot more use of polling. So anonymous polling, which you're starting to see on the conference circuit, and people might use a Slido or a Mentimeter or one of these other polling apps. Now I'm seeing that happen much more within these virtual team meetings or these virtual events, where you can ask people how they're feeling or what they're thinking, and they know it's anonymized because it's a third-party tool. And if you're brave, you can have these comments pop up on the screen and sort of manage them as they do. Or, you know, as an event MC, you know, you can track the questions and sort of pop up the ones that are most impactful or the ones that fit what you're trying to accomplish with your event. And that's another form of listening, right? Letting people have the stream as if they were in the room and asking a question. Or if they're in the room and they're afraid to ask the question, you know, some cultures really frown upon, some corporate workplace cultures really frown upon asking questions, or certain people will ask the same question and get two different, really different responses from it. And so having this anonymized question where you don't know the person who's asking it can mean that questions get answered in a more fair and unbiased way. So tons and tons of tools that people can take into the virtual space that actually might give you more information than you would get if people were there in person and not comfortable asking a question or saying something.
That's fantastic advice. Thank you very much. I'm mindful of your time. I don't want to keep you too long, but there's something that I wanted to pick up from a couple of questions ago. You mentioned six, I believe, symptoms of a toxic culture. Could you elaborate on that? Because I know there's an article that I definitely will include in the show notes, but I would love to hear from you as well a bit more about it.
So M-Train published a culture report. It's a workplace culture report 2020 that was published by M-Train in March. We look at six indicators of workplace health, and there are a few that are coming from the organization and a few that are from the people. On the organizational side, we're looking at the organizational norms and behaviors, so that how things really work around here. We're looking at power dynamics, so how people in authority use their power, or in some cases abuse their power, or in some cases just don't realize the impact of their words and actions because they are a manager or a leader in the organization. And then we also look at in-groups and out-groups. So from sociology, the term would be tribalism. From behavioral science, it's in-groups, out-groups, and we will often call it us versus them. Right. So what group do you feel aligned with, and how are you interacting with another group that maybe you don't get to have that same alignment? And it can be anything from men versus women to internal sales versus external sales. And it's not really so much a group or a department, It's when you say, well, they do it this way, and that's the problem, that you're getting into this in-group, out-group. Then there are three dynamics that are more about individuals: unconscious bias, social intelligence, you know, can you pick up in the mood in the room? And then social intelligence, unconscious bias, and I'm forgetting the sixth offhand. Just I have it right here. Pre-existing mindsets. So the sixth indicator is those pre-existing mindsets, those assumptions around behavior and how things might work that come from your life experiences. So for example, if there's a sales leader and they yell a lot and you're really used to that because sales leaders always yell, that's like a norm for you. That's just the way sales works. Or salespeople are aggressive. You know, that's sort of your pre-existing mindset around a behavior that's acceptable because that's what you're used to seeing. Whereas it really doesn't make sense for sales leaders to yell. It's usually like not a great way to be with clients and with your peers and colleagues. So those pre-existing mindsets are a little bit more difficult to track. M-Train's come up with some intellectual property that allows us to track those. But a really important differentiator, because everybody has different expectations, and understanding where those don't align can really explain why some people have more difficulty interacting than others. So those are the six indicators of cultural health. And you know, what we're doing at M-Train within our trainings is asking questions around those so that we can understand and score and then benchmark companies on those indicators.
That's great. Thank you very much. I'll be sure to include the link to M-Train in our show notes so people can follow up and learn a lot more. Last question. If anyone wants to get in touch, say thank you for sharing your knowledge, or simply ask you any questions, or maybe get your services, what's the best way of people finding you or reaching out to you? What's your preference?
I'm pretty easy to find on LinkedIn. There's only one Lorraine McKinnon. If you've got my name spelled there, L-A-R-A-I-N-E, it's pretty easy to find me.
Fantastic. We'll include a link to your LinkedIn as well. And it's been a joy. Thank you very much for devoting some of the time of your day to join me for the show and share your knowledge.
Yeah, thank you very much. And I'm excited to see where you go on deeper mental health with people who have more expertise and experience, because I think it's a really important topic to be exploring. So I look forward to listening to the rest of the series.
Usually once the mics are off, I continue chatting to my guests. And Lorraine has mentioned Black Lives Matter. So I thought, you know what, we can't leave this out. So we quickly switched the microphones back on, and I've asked her about what she has noticed in terms of how organizations are handling this challenging topic, how does it feed into their biases, and here is what she had to say.
It's certainly a reckoning for companies. The whole point of Black Lives Matter, from my perspective, is that these injustices have been going on for hundreds and hundreds of years, and they really haven't been addressed in a way that puts Black lives equal to other lives. And that's part of why you're seeing the outrage from a really diverse set of people. For companies, there's sort of this extra lens, right? Because they've been dabbling in unconscious bias and trying to understand where their organizations, you know, may have some improvements to make, but they've never really looked at the experience of a Black colleague and understood how much extra work, extra preparation, how much more doubt that person faces when they bring forth an idea, how those people are often not heard. This is true for any minority in any organization, but it's been certainly followed along the social lines. So when you're looking at some of the diversity and inclusion numbers and you see how few Black people are in the ranks of leadership and even sort of mid-level management, it's pretty clear that there are biases that are preventing people from the career acceleration that you would expect. There's research from Being Black in Corporate America from, I think, the ELT that basically says Black men and women are more ambitious than their colleagues. So it has proven that there are many people who desire to be in those elevated ranks, and something's holding them back. And so companies are going out and saying Black Lives Matter, and they're making big announcements and pronouncements. And yet there's a lot of cleanup, a lot of house cleaning to be done within organizations to understand how deep these biases are and how many people are working so much harder than their peers just to get recognized in approximately the same way. There's so much more work to be done. And so I think it's great. I think it's great that we are all much more aware and happy to help any companies that aren't quite sure what to do next. There have been some events around Black Lives Matter trying to bring more Black perspectives to the forefront, and it's an amazing time for listening.
One more thing before you take off. If you enjoyed listening to the show and found it of value, I'd really appreciate if you shared it with your network and considered leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you might be listening to it. Also, if you've got any questions, any suggestions of topics to cover, guests to invite, please drop me an email on nextsteppodcast@human.pm. If you want to find out a bit more about Next Step Group, please visit www.nextstep.group. This podcast is produced and hosted by Lech Kuzowski from Human PM. Special thanks to the founders of the Next Step Group, Christina Barger, Jelaine Chan, Stefan Dorn, and Matteo Grassi.